The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is George Lipsitz. George is a professor of Black Studies and Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His previous books include The Possessive Investment of Whiteness, How White People Profit from Identity Politics, How Racism Takes Place, and A Life in the Struggle, Ivory Perry and the Culture of Opposition. He serves as senior editor of the Comparative and Relational Ethnic Studies Journal, KAIFU. Did I say that right?
KAIFU,
thank you. He has written a new book with Barbara Tomlinson. It's called Insubordinate Spaces, Improvisation and Accompaniment for Social Justice. George Lipsitz, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
We've covered quite a bit of ground on this podcast in that we attempt to look at the full spectrum of improvisation, how it relates to business, faith, crisis, learning. But there is a rich tradition in our field of improvisation as a tool of social justice. Augusto Ball was a Brazilian theatrical practitioner who developed theater of the oppressed in the 1970s. And since Second City itself has a rich tradition in creating satire that attempts to speak truth to power, I was really intrigued to read this book. So I think it's probably best to start with some definitions. You write, quote, "In this book, we propose the idea that new practices, new politics, and new polities are emerging inside what we call insubordinate spaces." So give us your definition of insubordinate spaces.
I think that most of the spaces we inhabit come to us prefabricated with certain assumptions already in them. So the jobs we work at, the schools we attend, the media messages that come to us have been well prepared to produce certain kinds of results. They often, there's often a great amount of money invested in them because the assumption is they will lead to the conclusions that they intend to create. We're interested in the things that interrupt that, what C. Wright Mills used to call the centralized say-so, the normal way of doing things, the path that's already been set out. We're not interested in the path people take. We're interested in the path people make. And we think that there's a lot of what we call self-activity going on in community groups. You mentioned in theater and theater games, in many areas of the arts, but also in nearly every area of social life where people have to make choices and make decisions, where the things that are planned don't conform to the blueprint that they were created with, and people have to make decisions. And often we experience those moments as crises, that we don't have a one career, we have many different jobs. We don't have our family with us all the time because people move and or people get deported or there's an illness that comes along. But we think a lot of the greatest things in life and the greatest things in a decent and democratic society come from the improvisations that are made in these spaces that aren't structured in dominance, that don't follow the path of subordination, that basically create the possibility of new things happening, new and unexpected things.
And I think it's important to note that you also say that insubordination is, in this context, is a tool rather than a goal, and it's also politically and morally neutral, right?
Yeah, that, you know, we're not just interested in saying no, in being oppositional.
Yeah.
A lot of our friends in East Los Angeles with the East Los Angeles Community Corporation say we want to be propositional, not oppositional. It's not enough to be against bad things. Being against something bad doesn't make you good. Being negative and contrary sometimes simply reflects the way the society and its power structure have been set up to be. So we do think some kinds of insubordination are necessary, but only if they're a tool to self-activity, to democracy, to decency, to creating new possibilities, to replacing competition with co-creation, with enabling people to experience difference without domination. These are things that we think can happen in insubordinate spaces, but simply declaring yourself insubordinate or oppositional is not enough.
You give examples in the book, and I was surprised and then not when you talked about Archbishop Oscar Romero as an incredible example of the kind of work that you're talking about here in these insubordinate spaces. Talk to us a bit about why you focused on Romero.
Yeah, well, Romero is a great intellectual guide to us, and he had a life that I think holds important lessons for people everywhere. For him, they took place in the context of being a Catholic clergyman in the country of El Salvador, especially in the 1970s. He had reached his 50s, moved steadily up within the church, within a clearly subordinate space set up to not have surprises and to not have improvisation. And he was trying to preach the gospel in a country ruled by a small elite, riddled by warfare, and he was talking to his parishioners about a peace they would find in the next world, but not being able to do anything about the miserable conditions they endured in this one. And instead of scolding them, instead of simply studying and consulting the church hierarchy, he decided to learn from them and with them. Mm. He attended peasant liberation theology classes, where people discussed what they thought the meaning of the gospel was, where they brought in their experiences. And some of the people in those conversations had no education. Others were highly educated and were theological experts. And they felt they had to work out, they had to devise a common understanding of what it meant to live honestly and honorably in this world. Romero, as he got more involved with the peasants, became less interested in the things that used to concern him. He was very interested in church politics, and he wanted to rise. He had not been a wealthy man but he became a favorite of the wealthy in the church. And the more he pleased them, the higher office he got. And he found himself very concerned with wearing the right vestments at services and having people operate according to plan. In a time when people were suffering, at a time when people were dying in a country that was falling apart. And he said, once I learned from the peasants, I began to see the gospel in an entire new way. In fact, I've learned what the gospel means for the first time. And so he became closer and closer to the peasants, and he developed the idea that's crucial to us of accompaniment. This is the key phrase that we take from Archbishop Romero, and it's a problem that I think all of us encounter. It's one thing to call for human interaction with other people. It's one thing to say we should all get along, we should all be nice to each other. That's easier said than done. So many things divide us by language, by privilege, by level of education, by our embodied identities, our religions. You can't just magically know how to interact with others in a society whose subordinating institutions have encouraged us to be selfish and self-interested. So Romero said people need to go on a journey, very much like the journey he went on, going to the national reality classes, walking by the side of the peasants, trying to learn from and with them. And he said accompaniment means it's almost as if we're marching down a road together. It's not a parade because there's not a drum major in front and there's not a band beating out the rhythm by which we march. It's not an organization where somebody orders you to do certain things. It's a loose collection of people walking down the road who keep their eye on each other, who look out for each other. And in Romero's view, as we walk down this road, it's going to be very hard for us to understand each other across boundaries. If you have a roof over your head and meat and bread on your table every night, you don't really understand what it means to be hungry. No matter how much sympathy you have, no matter how much anguish you have over what it might mean to be hungry, you don't really know. And if you're homeless, if you're hungry, if you've been abused your whole life, it's very hard for you to cooperate and to trust people who've never seemed to care about your suffering. But Romero says, in accompaniment, we can work this out. We can look at each other. We can have conversations. And he felt these should be organized around what, for him, was called the preferential option for the poor. Now, this is a doctrine of Catholic theology that began in South America in the 70s. It's often misunderstood in the U.S. because the word option in the U.S. means just choice, like a thing from the menu. And so it makes it seem like the poor get the first choice. And that's not what Romero said. In Spanish, option is really more like a commitment. And he said, whatever we do, there ought to be a concern for the most oppressed, for the people likely to be left out, the people whose interests are likely to be ignored. Because that doesn't mean that we say whatever the poor do is fine, and we turn a blind eye to the cruelty that they can engage in to each other, to the destructive habits they have. That's not showing love for them. That's a kind of condescension. Mm-hmm. We try to work out the problems, but in everything, we try to give first priority to the interest that might be left out. And so for Barbara Tomlinson and I in this book, we think this can be applied to other circumstances. In some cases, it should be a preferential option for those who are poor. But in other cases, it might be religious or sexual minorities. It mm-hmm. might be people with disabilities. It might be those who were not thought of when the plan was made. And we have to constantly recreate a social charter by walking down the road, keeping our eyes on each other, and knowing that we won't have uniformity, but we can have some kind of unity. We don't have to be identical. And in fact, it's better off to appreciate different identities. We're not interested in only solid areas of sameness where we say those people are just like us. We're interested in the dynamics of difference when we see how much we can learn by savoring the things that unite us and the things that divide us, because both of them enable us to learn and challenge us to improvise and create new paths.
There's so much there. Keith Johnstone, who wrote the book Impro, he defines improvisation as walking backwards into the future, because you can't really see what's in the future. But what you are picking up on is the things that you've done, the people you see. And then when you're walking backwards, you can see to the side, too, in terms of who's coming with you. And I thought it was really interesting. You write in the book, quote, in order for social change to take place, it takes places. And I don't like that was not something that I ever thought about, like, you do need to have this sort of idea of a place. And you talk about Romero actually going to the place of the peasants, and that is not what archbishops do, I think, traditionally. Right. They're very sealed off.
Yeah,
and I live in Chicago. Right. We are literally divided by highways to keep the black people from the white people. And then the tendency, of course, sort of liberal white do-gooder is to go there and offer your help with your ideas. But that's not it either, because you need to meet people and experience what they're experiencing and hear and listen to them. And that is not, for some reason, a natural act.
Yeah, I think that's really nicely said. And, you know, the anthropologists talk about liminal spaces, spaces that are kind of in between, that don't conform to a rigid division between insiders and outsiders. Mm. So Kevin Mumford and other historians have talked about these areas of cities that were often on the edge of industrial zones or near a seaport, where different kinds of social relations were possible. They were places often where people of different races got together. Sometimes they were sites of queer sociality. Sometimes they were bohemian sites of countercultures where unexpected affiliations and alliances and conversations could be created. And so there's a long history of physical spaces like that. House music in Chicago and Detroit originated in many spaces like that. But there are also spaces that deliberately try to produce these new kinds of accompaniment. And sometimes they involve people coming from very far away. But sometimes a group needs to be unified. A group needs to get itself together. Just because you live on a reserve or reservation as an indigenous person doesn't mean you magically can interact with everybody in your group. Living in East Los Angeles in what has historically been a Chicano barrio doesn't mean there isn't a terribly radical divisiveness that keeps you separated and competing with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. So we talk about the ways in which the round dance of the I Don't Know More movement in Canada brought together indigenous people of different languages, religions, national tribal groups, different relations to treaties, but also then attracted the settler colonialists who saw in the indigenous protests a critique of extractionist, environmentally damaging procedures. In East Los Angeles, the fandango is a form of music that comes from the most Afro-centric parts of Mexico, from Veracruz. And it got revived in Los Angeles as a way to bring together people of different groups to give a new meaning to what it means to be from many different states of Mexico and be in the U.S., but also to have relations with African Americans who you're always told are your competitors, you're always told they're a threat, and yet Son Jarocho music enables you to remember, wait a minute, there's a long history of Africans in Mexico as well. And so that memory, that walking backwards as you describe it, and finding an African past in Mexico makes it easy today for young Black and Mexican youth to come together, to make music together, and then to talk about the conditions. That those music making that they make together involves songwriting workshops where they talk about the problems with punitive school discipline, the problems of food deserts in East Los Angeles, the problems of vendors being criminalized for trying to make a living, being told that their neighborhood will only be valuable if it can be gentrified and other people move into it. And so those songwriting workshops, which were really ways to just accompany one another, developed into conversations which have produced critiques, and they've led to social movement mobilizations.
So one of the things that you set up in the book is two things, Conescens and Balans. That's both Haitian in origin?
Yeah, these are terms that we got from our friends in Haitian studies, and in many ways, just as we draw on accompaniment from El Salvador, we're very interested in the Lavala movement in Haiti that coalesced around Jean-Bertrand Aristide, around these concepts of connaissance and balance. So connaissance is knowledge, but it's not book knowledge. It's not Google knowledge. It's not Wikipedia knowledge. It's knowledge that comes with experience. It's knowledge that is a collective intelligence honed from the survival strategies of oppressed people. It's finding out not what announces itself as important and knowledgeable, but what knowledge actually works. And so we're interested in following the people who serve the spirits and in the religious life in Haiti, who say you need to have connaissance, you need to know how things work in order to survive. But anything that enables also inhibits. Any medicine can be turned into poison. And so if you make a fetish out of knowledge, and academics like me often do this, you know, if you know more things and have written more books, you know, you think you're better positioned to solve moral problems. But that doesn't mean that. That means you have a certain set of tools, but everyone ought to have an equal voice in determining what a good society is, what humane and decent relations are. And often one kind of knowledge isn't very useful somewhere. The knowledge that's in libraries and in academic journals is often not valuable to people who have figured out how to survive homeless on the streets of Los Angeles, or how to endure as an indigenous person in the hinterlands of Canada. And again, we're looking for accompaniment. We're willing to have these different kinds of knowledge come together. And the moral framework for that is balance, this other concept from Haiti and from Aristide's movement. And that is, balance is you're not dividing the world into right and wrong and us and them. You're always looking for a unity of opposites. When people disagree with us, there's a reason why they disagree. You know, they may be wrong, but in their understanding, there's a logic behind it. And if we want them to see the part of the truth that matters to us, we have to understand the truths that matter to them. And we have to look for a balance of these things. We don't want to wipe out the other side the way lawyers do in a trial. We want to reconcile. We want to follow the principles of restorative justice. We want to have conversation, and we want to come to consensus with people in which everyone is involved in formulating the decision. Because if everybody's involved in making decisions, then they're going to have a commitment to enforcing those decisions that we make. If decisions are made by a 5-4 majority vote, and the five have vilified and demonized the four, they've won the argument, but they've ruined the social fabric that people will need to walk down the road together.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I've worked at Second City for over 30 years, and we have a very interesting ecosystem that has existed since 1959 when it was founded, which is that the main stage cast, which is usually six people, three women, three men, they are basically, they run the roost. So they get to create their shows. There is essentially no censorship. I don't think there's really any censorship, but there is guidance. But they are given their space, and that has been, and because it's always sort of young people, new young people coming in, we're constantly sort of readjusting our language and learning from the youth in terms of, okay, what words can we, you know, do we need to now reframe or relook at or change? But I've also seen when that balance becomes askew, when we're not able to sort of give our wisdom to the next group of young people, they don't want to hear it, or vice versa, we assert too much control, that's where things, you know, ultimately break down. And it sort of feels like, you know, when Second City is working, it is these two things in harmony. And often there is the tension is a lot, where a lot of great stuff comes from, because you're really, everyone's forced to acknowledge it and face it and understand the tensions that we all experience, and hopefully, and I don't know what the secret sauce there is to get people then to move forward together. Sometimes it just happens. I imagine there's different reasons why it does or doesn't.
It's always going to be harder in the short run. We have winners and losers in the short run.
Yeah.
Young people want to throw out the past. Old people want to hang on to what has worked for them. You know, there are ways of getting stuck, ways of, as Malcolm X used to say, thinking you're militant, but really only being dogmatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can become attached to, in a kind of vain way, your ways of living in the world, and then close yourself off to the things you need to hear and learn from others. And a lot of some of this can happen very subtly within organizations with their understandings of expertise. We talk briefly in the book about the adaptive use musical instrument, which Pauline Oliveros developed. And this is a computer technology that allows people with either uncontrolled physical movements or very limited physical movement to compose and to play music, because computer sensors pick up movements of their eye or movements of their body that translate into making music. And they're no longer bound by having to be physically able to play a saxophone or to play the drums, both of which are great. We like people who can play the saxophone. We like people who can play the drums. But we shouldn't impoverish the world of music to think that because able bodies have been needed to play musical instruments for hundreds of years, that's the only way music can be made. Mm-hmm. And so Pauline developed this adaptive use musical instrument, and initially it was used in therapy only for people who had what are considered to be disabilities, but even that is a judgment. It's a social construction of what makes you able or disabled in any particular situation. And she found value in undervalued people. She found value in an undervalued site. And then the so-called able-bodied musicians found that they liked playing with these computer instruments as well as their regular, traditional instruments, because it meant something, some new kind of music could be made. Mm-hmm. And so there was the traditions of the past, you know, which have produced many things, and we ought to respect them. We don't disrespect any form of art or any form of knowledge, but they can also squander the talents and abilities of people who are not included. They can lessen the free interaction among humans that is needed both for creativity and for social justice.
You introduced me to a term in this book, and I think, you know, through the eyes of understanding some of the things that happened in Ferguson before, during, after, the term is methodological individualism. Yeah. And so talk to us about what that is, and especially in this context of Ferguson, because I think it was such a powerful chapter for me.
Yeah, well, we learned so much from Ferguson by thinking about the improvisation that, yeah, when Michael Brown was killed in August of 2014, it actually was not an unusual event, you know, that many black youths have been killed in a similar situation. What made it different was that people on their social media devices broadcast pictures. Michael's stepfather made a handmade sign that said, "Ferguson police just murdered my unarmed son." And they improvised. They created a new network. Now, part of that was because many of them had already been involved in hip hop, in underground raves, where they essentially created flash mobs to go to a place in no time flat. And they expressed a solidarity with Michael Brown that was not coherent to the Ferguson police force, to the city officials, to St. Louis County, to any of the elected officials. They wondered why people would have solidarity with this 18-year-old kid. Even if you saw his death as unfortunate, you wouldn't understand why it would produce this massive outpouring, people being willing to face rubber bullets fired at them, concussion grenades going off, tear gas being fired at them. And basically, it has to do with this idea of methodological individualism, that the dominant subordinating institutions of the society say that everything that happens is just the sum total of a series of individual actions. So if Michael Brown gets in a fight with Darren Wilson, one of them did something wrong and mm-hmm. should be held accountable, and the only question is which one. Mm-hmm. And so that 90-second encounter becomes all you look at because you want to know who was the guilty party that interrupted things. But that 90-second encounter hides the 90 years in the city of St. Louis of housing discrimination, of predatory policing, of people being pushed out of the Mill Creek Valley, which was destroyed for urban renewal, into Pruitt-Igoe, which was then blown up and torn down, into North County apartments that they were renting with Section 8 vouchers, that because landlords everywhere won't take Section 8, it was very clear the police were able to see who's poor and who isn't. And once you had a warrant, every arrest added on to that. And then you got fines and fees you couldn't afford to pay, so you lost your job and you got evicted. And a whole series of things that fit together collectively, cumulatively, and continuously are unknown if you only think of the world as a series of individual actions that happen one at a time. And so this methodological individualism always asks you to say who's the criminal, but not what is the crime. It asks you to look at what disrupted the status quo, not whether the status quo was honest or honorable to begin with. And so what we saw in that collective outpouring in Ferguson were young people who used improvisation to speak about things that went beyond the philosophy of methodological individualism. Mm-hmm. And so often what they said in the streets and in on their signs and in their slogan was, I am Mike Brown. Now, they knew they weren't Mike Brown, but what they were saying was their fate was linked to the fate of Mike Brown. And it wasn't just black people who said that. It mm-hmm. was people from all over the city, people of different ages, people of different races and religions and social bearing who said, you know, there's something wrong here. And it's not an injury that I feel sorry for somebody else about. It's an injury to my sense of self, my sense of decency, my sense of the way the world ought to be.
And this, you point out the New York Times reporter who wrote the article alleging that Michael Brown, quote, was no angel, end quote. And I don't think there was a Darren Wilson article with the same title.
Quite the contrary. That in fact, Darren Wilson has exactly the complicated home life that people assumed was responsible for Michael Brown. Darren Wilson had several fathers. His mother went to jail for writing checks that she couldn't back up. Wilson had been involved in fights with his wife's ex-partner, and he had this chaotic life. And I don't fault him for that. I understand the circumstances yeah. that produced that in Darren Wilson's life. But he's always considered to be somebody who overcame that because he became a policeman. Well, to become a policeman in Ferguson, you know, a force that has 64 officers, 60 of whom are white, you obviously have an advantage if you're white. This is in a city that's two-thirds black. And so the privilege, the advantages that he had make him not accountable for anything in his past. And again, I don't think he should be held accountable for who his parents were or anything like that. But Michael Brown was considered a villain for being shot. And the person who shot him is considered innocent. The person who gets shot has to make a claim that he's not an angel in order for the death to be grievable. And so we thought that was a telling turn of phrase. And as we say in the book, it happens elsewhere. The you see the shooters who murdered nine men and women in Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. When he's caught by the police, they take him to Burger King. They buy him a hamburger and fries. Michael Brown didn't kill anybody, and he gets shot as a suspect in Tamir Rice, 12 years mm-hmm. old, is shot in Cleveland for doing nothing. But mass shooters who are white get, you know, peacefully taken to jail. And again, I don't want them killed, but I'm just saying that when a movement comes up that says Black Lives Matter, that's part of what they mean, that a black life is not taken seriously, and a white life is given a lot of leeway. There's a sociologist named Deval Pager, who sadly died last year, who did a study, and she found that employers preferred whites with criminal records to blacks with clean records, because when they looked at the name and thought that somebody was black, they assumed the person without a criminal record was a criminal. And the ones who actually had a criminal record, because they were white, they said, well, this must be, he must have outgrown that. That must have been a small thing. And so these things are very deep, and they can't just be disrupted by lawsuits or by hectoring. We need a different way of understanding our relations to each other as humans.
I'm going to ask you in a second for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But I do want to talk a little bit about sort of the last couple chapters in the book, where you talk about neoliberalism as knowledge projects and academia. And the thing that was so upsetting to me is realizing how cemented certain language or names or maps have become that are built on, you know, not just mistakes, but you know, the suppressing of people's rights, the taking away of land from indigenous people, and, you know, just the term Indians, right? That is terrible.
That was Columbus's mistake, and that gets treated as the basis of knowledge.
Yeah, and the Mercator map, is that the? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Talk to us. Yeah, that just blew my mind.
Yeah, so, you know, the kind of, again, it goes back to connaissance and balance, that the core standards of knowledge have a hidden history in them. And again, we're not anti-intellectual. We don't disrespect knowledge. It's precisely because we value knowledge that we're concerned about how it gets distorted, how the disciplines that people learn in colleges and high schools all have their history in a time of the world when indigenous dispossession, slavery, empire, colonization were going on. And they all had a role in encouraging people to see the world in a way that made all of those things seem natural, necessary, and inevitable, and challenges to those things be seen as threatening. I often teach people about the United States in the mid-19th century, and we read about the abolitionist John Brown. And to this day, you know, John Brown is still considered to be a madman because he said slavery was a brutal, violent system that could only be overthrown with violence, and that if the United States does not deal with slavery, it would be cursed forever. This does not sound crazy to me.
No, it doesn't.
It's almost crazy. This is only crazy in a society where one person enslaving another and their descendants is considered sane. And so, you know, what we feel is that there needs to be both a radical revision, not only of rights, resources, and responsibilities, but also a revolution in knowledge production and distribution. And often what we see is that, again, the eyewitnesses to some of the most dire consequences of these things are producing new understandings of the world. It was very helpful for us to understand what's happening to the environment by taking seriously the I Don't Know More movement. Mm-hmm. It's very helpful for us in understanding why migration happens by sitting side by side at those fandangos and hearing how people narrate their histories. It was extremely important for us to interact with Tef Poe and Percy Green and other activists from Ferguson to understand that what we were reading in the newspaper or what we were seeing on the television was coming from a certain point of view that has some deep problems with it.
So true. Okay, so every guest that we have on the show, we ask for a yes and story. And in the parlance of improvisation, when you're making something out of nothing, you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten, which is certainly connected to some of the things that you talk about in the book. So I'm wondering if from your life or your work, if you have a time where maybe you surprised yourself by yes anding.
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, you indicated to me you were going to ask it, and I've thought about it a lot, and there are really a number of things that come up, and it really emphasizes the importance of making choices at moments. You know, often we think our everyday choices don't matter, but a small choice can make a big difference. The one that comes to the fore for me is about 5 years ago, I was asked by a scholar whose work I knew if I would write an introduction to a book that was authored by a learning community called Students at the Center in New Orleans. So these were 11th and 12th grade honors students in English and history who had a collaborative improvisational writing project. They worked so that one student reads a paragraph and then two others respond and then they revise it together and they create something that none of them intended to do. And I had read about this, and I knew the person who invited me. I knew about her work. And I could have just said, no, I'm too busy, or I could have said yes and stayed at my computer in my air-conditioned office and written something. But I thought, if I'm going to write this, I've got to accompany. I better go to New Orleans and attend these classes and meet these people and see what goes on. So I had no time to do it. I actually didn't even have the money to do it. Mm-hmm. But I thought I should, and so I went there. And I had the most amazing day in my life. I walked into these classrooms that had a friendliness, a sense of shared project that I haven't seen in my 40 years of university teaching. The students would come up to me with the kind of confidence, asking me who I was, why I was there, and what I thought about this or that. And then when the class started, I saw this improvisational pedagogy that the students read very difficult works and responded to them with two paragraphs, one about the work itself and the other about the way that work related to their own personal life. And then the pedagogy is that each student then picks two others who respond, and then the group speaks at large, and then they create a new kind of writing out of all of that. in the afternoon session, a guest walks in, a man who is 6.5 feet tall. He appears to be in his 70s. I don't know what he's doing there. Everybody else in the classroom is children and teachers. I had to go through a metal detector and a security thing to get in and get a badge. He has no badge. I don't know how he came in there. He starts talking in the middle of the class and encouraging the students, saying some nice things. And the teacher, wanting the students or me to know who this guy was, said, "Well, sir, could you introduce yourself to us?" And he said, "They call me Big Duck." Hmm. And he said, "When I was a child, I was tall, and my little friends came along with me," said, "There's the Big Duck and his little ducks." Hmm. And so that wasn't good enough. The teacher of the class said, "Well, what's your government name?" And the man said, "I am governed by the historical struggles of our people, and they have named me Big Duck." And so the teacher tries again. He says, "What's the name on your driver's license?" And he says, "Well, a driver's license is a administrative mode created by the carceral state designed to dehumanize us." So in despair, the teacher finally says, "Well, what did your parents call you?" And he said, "Oh, Jerome Smith." Hmm. Well, Jerome Smith was the 23-year-old who met with James Baldwin and a group of other intellectuals in 1963 to try to tell Robert Kennedy what was going on in the civil rights movement. Jerome Smith is somebody who for 50 years has organized young people to be involved in music, to be involved in politics, to be involved in theater. He's somebody I've probably quoted more in print than any other person except Martin Luther King, and I had never met him. And he just happened to be in that room, and it made me rethink him and his role. And part of what we say in the book is we want this not to be a book where we speak and people listen. We want this to be a book that helps people listen to Jerome Smith.
That's great. Yeah, that whole story. You know, I was born in Boston. My dad covered the Kennedys. There's a bust of John F. Kennedy in my parents' house growing up. You know, and then you over time you learn, oh my God, you know, that people aren't who you thought they were, or they're more complicated. Probably is the better way to put it. But what an amazing opportunity for you to meet one of your idols when you really were probably never going to reflexively go to that place.
Not at all. So I, you know, if I had just said yes or no, I wouldn't go, but I said, "And let me show up. Let me be there." And it made all the difference.
Yeah. The "and" is the best part. The book is called Insubordinate Spaces. George Lipsitz, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I really appreciate it.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.